We're going to start with a story. Story quoted by Rabbi Sacks in his book Future Tense. And it was in 1991. It was the first Gulf War. He was in Israel with his wife. And there were missiles that were launched into Israel, 39 missiles. And people, anytime the missiles would launch, would have to go into a sealed room, put on gas masks, and they don't know when the next missile is going to come, whether it's going to have chemical, biological weapons, agents within it. And there were almost no fatalities, which was the miracle, but there was a casualty. And the casualty was family life. Now, the following line might resonate a little bit with our current situation, but he writes, Israeli families were not used to spending prolonged periods together in a single room in situations of danger. They just weren't used to being isolated and quarantined and put into a situation, and there's anxiety and there's stress. We don't know what's going to happen. There's danger. So the mayor of Jerusalem, Teddy Kollek, called up Rabbi Sacks and asked him to be a part, the rabbinical member of a working group to try and figure out the best way to deal with family stress. Now, Rabbi Sacks, as we know, was from England, and he was just visiting Israel at the time. So he was perplexed. He's like, I'm just a tourist here. Why are you, are there no rabbis in Jerusalem, right? This is Yerushalayim we're talking about. Are there no rabbis in Jerusalem that you could have called to be on this panel, to be on this group of thinkers to figure out what's happening with the Israeli families? So the reply came back, and this is the end of the paragraph here on the top of the page. We have many rabbis, but none expert in family psychology. And Rabbi Sacks concludes that story by saying, a rabbinate untrained in the wisdom of the world will find itself irrelevant to those immersed in the world. And this story frames that chapter in Future Tense where he talks about the imperative for not just rabbis, but for everybody, for every Jew to have exposure to the outside world. Primarily, as you see here in the next section, to change the world, you have to understand the world. And this is, before we speak about psychology particularly, to understand Rabbi Sacks' thought more broadly, he was out to change the world, and he thinks that the Jewish mission is to change the world. Well, we can't change the world if we don't understand the world. So he creates a whole theology, a whole system of thinking that allows us to not just, oh, I have to get a college degree because I need to get a job because I have to support a family. But, you know, Nebuch, what can I do? All this wisdom, all these classes are just a waste of time, but I got to support a family. No, there is something holy, and there is something not just holy, but vision, a dream, a goal, a passion to understanding the outside world. And here he sets up a distinction between Torah and Chachma, but the distinction between Torah and Chachma, which we'll explain, goes back and he creates a whole narrative, and this is what he does so well. He doesn't just communicate an idea. He shows you how that idea, like, there's no other way to look at it, right? It's so clear the way he presents it and the amounts of evidence that he brings, and he creates a narrative that this is clearly what is going on and what needs to be done. So he writes here, I have argued not only in this chapter, but throughout the book, that a basic duality runs through Judaism, shaping its view of the world. It honors both the universality of the human condition and the particularity of Jewish faith. These are the two things. There's a universal message, a universal picture, and a particular. There's what we have as Jews. And now he frames that through so many different things. So the Torah contains two stories. One from Adam to Noah, that's the universal. And the other from Abraham to Moses, that's the particular. It contains two covenants, one with all of humanity, the other with the people of Israel. There are two different names of God. There are two manifestations of God, one in creation, which is universal, the other in revelation, which is particular. And there are two forms of knowledge, Chachma and Torah. Neither displaces or supersedes the other. To be a Jew is to be both. We are part of humanity and its story, and we are children of Abraham and Sarah, and their story. So we have these two parts to the Jewish mission and the Jewish vision. One is particular to us, and one is looking at the broader world and impacting the broader world. And in order to do that, we don't just have Torah, but we also have Chachma. So what's Chachma, and how does it differ from Torah? So here, on the right-hand side of the page, he writes, we can now state the difference between the two modes of knowledge. Chachma is the truth we discover. Torah is the truth we inherit. Chachma is the universal heritage of humankind. Torah is the specific heritage of Israel. Chachma is what we attain by being in the image of God. Torah is what guides us Jews as the people of God. Chachma is acquired by seeing and reasoning. Torah is received by listening and responding. Chachma tells us what is. Torah tells us what ought to be. Chachma is about facts. Torah is about commands. Chachma yields descriptive scientific laws. Torah yields prescriptive behavioral laws. Chachma is about creation. Torah is about revelation. So here he takes these two paradigms, the universal and the particular, and the whole book, A Future Tense, runs through and tells you that story. And when it comes to wisdom, there's a wisdom of the outside world, and that's essential. It's different. It's not the same thing as Torah. It serves a different purpose. It's scientific. It describes, doesn't prescribe, doesn't tell us what to do, right? Scientists don't tell you what to do. They describe what the facts are, what the observations are. So psychology, as we'll see in a second, is actually going to be a paradigm of what he's going to describe as a chachma. But before we see that, there is a problem. And the problem is that chachma is dangerous. When we are exposed to the outside world and outside values, there's a danger inherent in that, that perhaps it will be antithetical to Torah. So Rabbi Sacks says, A, yes, there's risk. But that's part of life, is taking risks. Part of being a Jew is taking risks. But more importantly, he says, there's a difference between culture and wisdom. Chachma, we're talking about wisdom. Culture is when the people who are describing the wisdom try to seep in their own values into that discussion. So if you have a scientist who's just not just describing facts and observations, but giving their own narrative and their own spin and their own values and their own religion into that description of science, then that's not correct. He shouldn't, or she shouldn't be doing that. But that's where we come into a problem as Jews who believe in Torah. How do we distinguish between appropriate chachma and when chachma becomes culture, not wisdom, it's spun, and be able to get rid of that, be able to address that, be able to say that's not our values. And what he describes is a great distinction between two modes of therapy, two modes of psychology. One, where he says, is actually not science. It's not chachma. There might be some elements of wisdom in it, but it's more spin. It's more culture. When you think about Greek philosophy, going back before we get to psychology, when you think about Greek philosophy, and he spends a lot of time describing that there are elements of Greek philosophy that is chachma, that we should be learning from. But there are also elements of Greek philosophy that is just spin, it's culture, and it's antithetical to Torah that we need to be able to identify and push away. Perhaps we'll talk about the philosophical aspects a different time. But now focusing on the psychological aspects, there are elements of psychology that are wisdom that we have a responsibility to understand and to learn and to describe and go through all of that list of what Chachma does. And that's what we're responsible to do as people who have to look at the outside world and engage with the outside world. But there are possibilities of psychology that has with it elements that are inappropriate, that are not within the value system of Judaism. So he distinguishes here, this is all from the same book, Future Tense, he distinguishes here between Freud, who's the bad guy in this scenario, and subsequent psychologists who we'll spend a little bit of time talking about. So he writes that there is such a thing as Judaic wisdom, Torah allied with Chachma, however difficult this is to define or specify in advance. To give one example, by choosing to base his psychoanalytic theory on the Greek myth of Oedipus, Freud gave us an essentially tragic view of the human condition. And because of that, and he elaborates this on in a different place, because of that, and he's very critical. If you want to read every time he quotes Freud a lot. In a lot of his books he quotes Freud, in a lot of his Parsha essays he quotes Freud. Often he's quoting Freud to disagree with Freud, because a lot of Freud's ideas are not based on science, and this is a critique of Freud within the psychological community as well. He's not scientific, but he's more philosophical. He's more theoretical. There's more culture that gets involved with that. And once you have culture, you got to be careful. Is that culture, is that idea with Judaism or without Judaism? So Freud focused on the tragic view of the human condition, and Rabbi Sacks is going to argue that that's incorrect. But three figures, and these are important figures, because he's going to create a system of a vision of where Torah and psychology can come together based on these three figures. The three figures since, one is Viktor Frankl, who gave people hope in Auschwitz, Aaron T. Beck, who developed cognitive therapy, and Martin Seligman, who pioneered the field of positive psychology, produced a set of understandings of the human mind and its emotions far more in keeping with the spirit of Judaism. Nor is this a marginal phenomenon for a religious point of view. Maimonides, the Rambam, called his ideal type, the sage, a rofe nefashos, a healer of souls, in a word, a psychotherapist. So there is within psychology, assuming that your background and you're starting with a vision of Chachma, that can not only stand to be parallel to Torah, but can actually be infused with Torah. If the starting point, if your hashkafos, if your belief system is aligned with Torah values and you put psychology within that system, there can be an ally, Torah can be an ally with Chachma, not just parallel, but you can actually pin them off of each other. And that's what we're going to develop over the course of the night, is to show that these aren't just two parallel tracks. These are two tracks that, in Rabbi Sachs's thought, were integrally connected to each other, that you can use psychology to understand Torah better, and you can use Torah to understand psychology better. In his book, it's not his book, but the book that was written for him as he retired from from the chief rabbinate, so Radical Responsibility, which is a great book, highly recommended, not written by him, but written by scholars about thoughts and ideas that are related to his thought. The last chapter there is written by, it's an afterword, by Tamara Wright, where she calls the chapter A New Musser. And what she basically jumps off of is this piece in Future Tense, where Rabbi Sacks talks about what a psychology and Judaism can look together and says, let's create a system of what would be a new Musser. Musser was the term used 100 years ago, still popular today, in terms of behavior change. But we can create, following the system of Aaron Beck, who developed cognitive therapy, and Martin Seligman, who started the movement of positive psychology, is that we can marry those ideas when it's appropriate. We have to be able to discern when it's real chachma and when it's spin. And that takes wisdom, and that takes thinking, and that takes knowing Torah really well. But if we can do that, she lays out a framework where we can create a system of change that combines the wisdom of psychology and the tradition of Torah. And to see that in a little more depth, we'll go back to something where the Rabbi Sacks writes, and we're going to transition now from one book to another. And what we're going to do is I'm going to show you within his books on the Parsha, which you see this little picture here, there are to date 9 books published by Rabbi Sacks on his Parsha thought. The first five are called Covenant and Conversation, which he has around each book is on one sefer. So it's Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim. And in each book, he has around 4 to 5 essays on each parsha, and they're mind-boggling. They're, you know, these are the things that people read all the time, you know, bring to shul in the parsha sheets, Covenant and Conversation. They were compiled. You can actually get them for free online, but they're compiled in book form in those first five books. And then the subsequent, after that, each year, he focused on ceremony and celebration is on the holidays. And then each year, he focused his parsha work on a different theme. So there was one year where he focused on leadership, one year where he focused on ethics, and then the latest book that just came out is Judaism's Life-Changing Ideas. So in that, you get all of the parshios together with one essay about that topic on the parsha covering the whole book. So all of that you can actually find online. I'm actually going to give you links to some things that you can explore on your own if you're interested. But before we get into the detail of one of the things that he writes here, I'm going to quote to you what he says in the beginning of the introduction to Genesis, where he describes what he's doing in these Parsha analyses. And he says that many people, when they write about the Parsha, or they write about Judaism, they write with microscopes, meaning they'll go and they'll find a nuance and they'll analyze that nuance and maybe you'll come out with an idea, but it's a very sort of micro perspective. And he says he's going to look at Judaism and the Parsha with a telescope, right? The big picture. And really that frames a lot of what he writes and why his writing is so uplifting, because he's not just looking at, sometimes it's interesting, it's cute. You look at a nuance, you get a nice gematria, you get, right, you have a nice vort that you can say over. That's nice. Again, that's great. But that's not what he does. He takes that and then makes it the biggest thing in the world, right? This is what we're all about. This is the mission of Jews. This is the mission of the world. This is how we can impact the world. So he takes the ideas and looks at it, again, with a telescope. And included in that is that he's going to incorporate within his essays ideas that are not just microscopic about Judaism, but he's going to incorporate ideas from outside secular culture, or secular wisdom, rather, better phrase to use, in order for us to understand the Jewish ideas better, and in order for the Jewish ideas to be able to impact the narrative in the outside world as well. So it's a symbiotic relationship. We learn from outside, and part of his big vision is that what we have can impact the outside as well, and we're not going to proselytize, you know, we're not going to get people to convert, but our voice of Judaism should be in the mainstream impacting what people are thinking about. And that's why his new book, Morality, does just that. Here are Jewish ideas that impact how we look at morality and how we look at culture and society nowadays. It was written not for Jews. It was written a Torah book for everybody. So, with that in mind, let's look at how he uses psychology within his understanding of various Parsha ideas. The first one we're going to look at is a direct continuation of what he wrote in Future Tense. In Future Tense, we just finished off by saying, is that Freud, we're going to push away because he was too influenced by not Chachma, but by outside alien philosophical ideas that are antithesis to Torah. But instead, we're going to focus on the ideas that overlap and that can actually be learned in consonance with Torah. So he first quotes Freud, and he says he got into trouble for critiquing Freud, but we'll leave that for a different point in time. But he says he sticks to his guns and says, Freud is out of the picture. But by contrast, you have, and these are the three names we said before, but he elaborates and spells out what they do in a little bit more detail. So Viktor Frankl, who survived Auschwitz, so if you ever read Rabbi Sachs's works, he basically quotes Frankl almost in every book. It's if you read The Great Partnership, where he talks about Torah and science, you know, Viktor Frankl serves as the paradigm for what religion is about. It's about meaning. Which is actually very similar to what we started off talking about in terms of Torah versus Chachma, but we'll save that analysis for a different time. Viktor Frankl is a pillar of Rabbi Sacks' thought. So Viktor Frankl was a survivor of Auschwitz, and based on his experiences in Auschwitz, he created what was called logotherapy and wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning, highly recommended. And his main point that he takes out of that is that no matter what's going on around me, no matter what the situation is, people can try to control me, but I have the freedom to decide how I want to respond. And that's point number one that Rabbi Sacks thinks is essential to Jewish life. I always have the freedom of choice to respond how I want to respond into in a situation. Person number two, Aaron Beck. So Aaron Beck was the founder of one of the most effective forms of psychotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy. He's started talking about healing people from depression. And what he came away with through his analysis is that there's a system of thinking, negative patterns of thinking that people go through who are depressed, and the same is true with anxiety and other emotions as well, that if we can change the way you think by thinking more realistically, logically, rationally, then the depression, the emotion, was changed as well. So this, again, is another pillar of an idea that we are going to say can be easily seen within Jewish thought. Number three is Martin Seligman. Martin Seligman is the founder of positive psychology, where he focuses on not just treating depression and anxiety and all the illnesses, but how do we work on the positive side of our human nature? How do we increase our happiness, our optimism? Right? So that whole field as well, Rabbi Sacks is arguing, it fits very nicely with several Jewish ideas. And he summarizes it in the following paragraph, where he says that what links all three thinkers is their belief that, one, there is always more than one possible interpretation of what happens to us. Always more than one possible interpretation. Number two, we can choose between different interpretations. And so there's many interpretations. I have the ability to choose which interpretation I want to follow. And three, the way we think shapes the way we feel. So the interpretation that I use can either help me feel better or help me feel worse. So lots of possible interpretations, right? The external doesn't make me think a certain way. I can input my own thinking. I can choose how I want to think about something. And depending on how I think, it's going to impact the way I feel. That's the core that he sees behind logotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy, and positive psychology. And he concludes by saying, this all is very reminiscent of Chabad Chasidut, as developed by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe in the Baal HaTanya, or Shneur Zalman of Liadi. The word Chabad is the initials of Chachma, Bina, and Daat, translated as wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, which influence the more emotional attributes. So the thinking influences the chesed, gvura, and tiferet, kindness, self-restraint, and beauty or emotional balance, which is, it's about how I think influences the way that I feel. And he sees this as a precursor to an anticipation of cognitive behavior therapy. So here's the marriage, right? Here's the overlap. The ideas at the core are the same, and these are things that we can use to be rofei nefashos, to heal people, to feel better, and to work optimally towards their goals. And then, since it's the Parsha, he sees this in the Parsha. So now, if I'm reading the Parsha, and I don't know anything about psychology, I'm not going to see this. But if I have these constructs, and I know what the outside wisdom says about something, and then I look at the Parsha, and my eyes can see those ideas in the Parsha, that can create new insights into the biblical text. So he says, Joseph, was the first cognitive therapist. He was the first to understand the concept of reframing. That is, seeing the negative events of his life in a new way, thereby liberating himself from depression and learned helplessness. And I'm not going to go into all the details. I gave you the link. You can see how he develops that within the story and the proofs that he brings. But you see here as a paradigm, here's a psychological idea. And that when I look at the story, now I can see, well, Yosef really was, everything was going bad. In prison, his life was going downwards. But he chose over and over and over again to reframe. He chose the way he's going to interpret. And he knew that depending on how he interpreted it, it will impact how he feels and how he reacts. So he chooses a way of thinking that leads to successful reactions, which eventually leads to a successful ending to the story. So this is one example that I think brings about a few things that we've been talking about. The importance of Chachma and Torah together, as well as how we can then see the text through that prism to get added insight into the story. What we're going to do for the rest of this year, after one short interlude, is see one more example that we're going to develop throughout three different times. He quotes the same psychological idea and uses it in three different ways. So we're going to develop that idea and see how it applies to his, to perhaps get insight into Rabbi Sacks' own life as well. But before we do that, a little interlude on what I think is gives us a glimpse into his Parsha style and his thinking in general that relates to psychology, but I think it's even is much bigger than that. And if you see here in source number 2, this is from Noach 5780, so written recently, he quotes a fascinating idea by writer David Epstein, who wrote the book Range. And the thesis of the book Range is that while there seems to be a push to specialize, right? You should always specialize in something. Subspecialty. You're a doctor. You can't be a generalist. You got to be a subspecialist. So he argues the opposite, is that generalists triumph in worlds that are specialized. Why is it that generalists triumph in a specialized world? So he makes the point that over-concentration on a single specialized topic is good for efficiency, but bad for creativity. The real creatives, people like Nobel Prize winners, are often those who have outside interests, who knew other disciplines or had passions and hobbies outside their subject. So I don't specialize. I actually know a lot about a lot of different things. And that helps me be creative to apply the things that I know about other things to what I'm studying now. And listen to his example. Lahav, this is almost autobiographical. It was precisely Maimonides' breadth of knowledge of science, medicine, psychology, astronomy, philosophy, logic, and many other fields that allowed him to be so creative in everything he wrote, from his letters to his commentary to the Mishnah Torah itself, structured differently from any other code of Jewish law, all the way to the Guide for the Perplexed. So everything Rambam wrote was because he was a generalist, because he knew so much about everything. Maimonides said things that many may have sensed before, but no one had expressed so cogently and powerfully. He showed that it is possible to be utterly devoted to Jewish life, to Jewish faith and law, and yet be creative, showing people spiritual and intellectual depths they had not seen before. That was his way of making a tzohar, a window for the teva, the divine word, right? The connection to Parshas Noach is that within the flood, you have this tzohar, this window that goes and sees outside. So he connects that to Rambam and to this idea from Range, which is basically the more you know about so many different things, the more you'll be able to creatively engage in a particular topic within Judaism. And again, this is an autobiographical statement. I'm sure he's not showing off by writing this, but this is Rabbi Sacks, right? This is, he knows the science, the psychology, the astronomy, you know, the philosophy, everything, the breadth that he quotes in his books and that he studies and is unparalleled. And then he comes to the Torah text and is able to show us things creatively that nobody else would be able to see because we don't have that breath. So this goes back to the same themes we've been talking about, Torah and Chachma. In order for me to have a better understanding of Torah, the breath of my Chachma is going to impact my Torah in a creative and way that's Maimonidean in nature. Right? This is for those who know Rambam. Rambam is Rambam, right? But this is exactly what Rabbi Sacks does. And if you look in the psychological realm, so I little text box on the side here, in the realm of his psychology, he has in the Parsha, he quotes studies on happiness, gratitude, mindset, altruism, evil, conformity, shame, grief, others as well, and we'll give one particular example of how he develops one theme. But there's dozens of psychological themes that he develops, and I quote for you here, we're not going to do this at all, but as you have a resource, if you ever want to see it, I have here, from number 7, we're doing 1 through 6 too, but here are 25 different ideas where he directly quotes a psychological concept. A person, a study, an idea about psychology, 25 different times in his Parsha Shirim, and it's more than that, right? Because sometimes they were doubled up and I just didn't quote to you everything. But at least 25 different times, different contexts, different subjects, he's quoting to you ideas from psychology. There you see Freud, Study, Maslow, Erickson, Kohlberg, Piaget, again Freud, there's Frankel, there's just Howard Gardner, Edith Eger, Martin Seligman, Carl Jung. He was familiar with so many different ideas in psychology, and he was able to then use those ideas to explain something that was happening in the Parsha. So let's, again, develop one particular idea, and this gets to the title of this year, which is Intellect versus Emotion. And the starting point is a book called Descartes' Error, written by a neuropsychologist by the name of Antonio Damasio. So Damasio has studied people who have brain injuries, and they have brain injuries in the parts of their brain that deal with emotions. And what he found was that these people were able to think rationally, because the part of their brain that was damaged was the emotion part, not the rational part. So they were able to think, but they weren't able to feel. But they weren't able to make choices. They weren't able to decide. They couldn't function. Even though they're able to think things through, pros, cons, they're able to tell it to you, almost like a Spock type of personality, totally rational mind. But they weren't able to hit the conclusion button, right? They weren't able to hit enter. They weren't able to actually decide what they wanted to do. And what Damasio develops is the theory, and it's been proven through his studies. Again, everything is a controversy and a debate in everything, but let's take it for granted for now, is that this dichotomy, this split that we have based on enlightenment and based on thinkers before that, between emotion and intellect, is a almost too strong of a split. There is no thinking that is divorced from some level of emotion. And perhaps we can say on the flip side, there is no emotion that is totally divorced from thinking. That there are not two separate tracks in our brain, thinking and emotion. They are actually intertwined. They're interwoven. That the decisions that we make are impacted by our emotions. So if you have somebody who can't feel, that's going to impact their thinking as well. That's what Damasio develops. Rabbi Sacks uses this idea in three different places to give us three different ideas about Judaism, about the Parsha, that are based on this insight of Antonio Damasio. So he writes here that one of the results of neuroscience is that we are becoming aware of the hugely significant part played by emotion in decision-making. The French Enlightenment emphasized the role of reason, regarded emotion as a distraction and distortion, right? Stop being so emotional, right? We know scientifically now that this is wrong. He quotes Damasio, Descartes' error, tells the story, and then he says, so what does that have to do with the Parsha? So he says, the last paragraph on this page, that as we can now see is the logic of the chukim, Parshas Chukas. We have statutes, the things in Judaism that seem to make no sense in terms of rationality, the mitzvot that we can't explain, the para aduma, right? There's certain shatnas, there's certain things that just don't make sense to us. We call them chok, statutes because they don't make rational sense. So he says, there have been many interpretations of the chukim throughout the ages, but in the light of recent neuroscience, we can suggest that they are laws designed to bypass the prefrontal cortex, the rational brain. Forget about thinking. And create instinctive patterns of behavior to counteract some of the darker emotional drives at work in the human mind. Again, in context, that'll make more sense if you want to read it. There's the link. But on a big picture, what he's doing is he's taking this idea from Damasio that our emotions are much more important than we think they are and saying, you think you're so rational. Well, here are a bunch of mitzvos that don't make any sense. We're going to make you behave in certain ways that you can now bypass that rationality so you can create behaviors and ways of interacting that aren't so rational for a good reason, because if sometimes you're too rational, that can actually be negative. And again, there are examples there of how that plays out. So this is one example of where he uses Damasio's study to explain to us the importance of emotion with intellect and the importance here of behaving in a certain way to bypass the rationality to create habits that counteract some of the darker emotional drives that we have. That's example number one. Example number two, he quotes Damasio, Parshas Achrimos, in the context of the two goats. When it comes to the Yom Kippur service, there are two goats. One we sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash, and one gets thrown off the cliff. There's a lot written on these two goats. But he explains, based on, after he starts in explaining Damasio's Descartes error, and then he quotes another psychologist, Daniel Kahneman, who is an example of somebody who actually, Daniel Kahneman is the only psychologist, he has a Nobel Prize in economics, because he created a new field called behavioral economics, which is exactly what Rabbi Sacks was talking about in terms of generalizing. He used his knowledge in psychology, applied it to economics, and was able to create a whole new system and change the whole field of economics. So there's a psychologist who's able to do that in economics. So he quotes Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking Fast and Slow, who says that we basically have two different tracks in our mind. We have one track that is rapid, instinctive, emotional, subconscious. The other is slower, conscious, deliberative, calculating. So on some level, you can understand this as these two elements. There's the, if you want to call it, the emotional side and the rational side. We can't go without one or the other. We can't just be, I will be hyper-rational and not think emotionally. It's impossible because it's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. The former, meaning the emotional part, allows us to react quickly to situations of immediate potential danger. If we didn't have that, without it, our ancestors would have not survived. Many of our instinctive reactions are benign. It is natural to have empathy, and with it, the tendency to feel other people's pains and come to their aid. We develop a strong sense of attachment, defends the community. So there's some quick emotional reactions that are beneficial. But not all instincts are benign. Anger, envy, jealousy, fear, hate, the desire for revenge may once have been functional, but they are often deeply destructive in social situations. That's why we need that second part of our brain, which thinks slower, which thinks rationally, can take a step back. Okay, so we have the ability to override our emotional experiences and not just, if they're dangerous, not just react on that instinct, on that emotion. And then, as he keeps doing, he now ties that to the Parsha. What does this have to do with the Parsha? He ties it to two Parshios. One, Genesis 27, Yaakov and Esav. These are two paradigms. Yaakov and Esav connect textually to the goats, because Yaakov and Esav brought goats for their father to eat. Right? So the two goats of the high priest service and the two goats prepared by Rebekah symbolize our duality. The hands are the hands of Esav, but the voice is the voice of Jacob. We each have an Esav, which is that impetuous side to us, that emotional side to us, and the Jacob, which is the slower, the thinking, the Yoshev Ohalim side to us, the impulsive emotional brain and the reflective deliberative one. We can think fast or slow. Our fate, our goral, going back to the goats that are sent over, they are decided by lot, right? They're chosen by a lottery. Our life script will be determined by which we choose. will our life be lived to the Lord or to the Azazel? Right? To the random vicissitudes or chance of chance. Right? So it's within our choice, going back to some themes, it's in our choice to choose how we want to react. So here he quotes Damasio, the importance of emotions, to realize we can't live without emotions. Many of the times, the emotions are beneficial. Remember that empathy, the good, the positive emotions are things that he's going to emphasize are essential for our lives. But there's a danger to emotions. Emotions can be, anger, envy, jealousy, fear, hate, can ruin our lives. They can ruin our social interactions. And that's why getting back to being able to find this balance, you can't just be emotional and you can't just be rational. You have to find a balance between the two, and we have to know how to override and use our intellect when necessary to control the darker sides of our emotional experience. So here's example number two, where he uses Damasio's research to create a system of thinking to understand the Parsha a little better. And here's the final one that he does, Torah as song. And I think this is going to help us. Each one adds another element, and this one actually transitions, sadly, to help us understand the end of his life. So this is Parshas Vayelech 57:75, Torah as song. Why is Torah called a song? At the end of Sefer Devarim, we read the song, Hazinu. Why is Torah called a song? Because if we are to hand on our faith and way of life to the next generation, it must sing. Torah must be affective, not just cognitive. Affective is emotional. It must speak to our emotions, as, he likes to quote for the third time now, Antonio Damasio showed empirically in Descartes' error. Though the reasoning part of the brain is central to what makes us human, it is the limbic system, the seat of emotions, that leads us to choose this way, not that. If our Torah lacks passion, we will not succeed in passing it on to the future. Music is the affective dimension of communication, the medium through which we express, evoke, and share emotion. Precisely because we are creatures of emotion, music is an essential part of the vocabulary of mankind. Skip a paragraph. So it is with a poetic sense of closure that Moses' life ends with the command to begin again in every generation, writing our own scroll, adding our own commentaries, the people of the book endlessly reinterpreting the book of the people and singing its song. The Torah is God's libretto, and we, the Jewish people, are his choir. Collectively, we have sung God's song. We are the performance of his choral symphony. And though when Jews speak, they often argue, when they sing in harmony, because words are the language of the mind, but music is the language of the soul. Here he uses Damasio to show the importance of the positive of our emotional life and how essential it is to develop our emotional connection to Judaism, to God, and primarily here emphasizing through singing. I will share with you at the end one idea about how he did this practically, but before we get there, one more Parsha thought. Here he doesn't quote Damasio, but it's the same thought, framed within psychology and Torah, of two relatives. One is Peter Soloveitch, and the other is Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. Who is Peter Soloveitch? So in March 2015, he had a public conversation at Yale with the university's president, Peter Soloveitch. The president pointed out that not only was Yale that afternoon hosting a rabbi, but he too, Soloveitch, was Jewish and the descendant of a great rabbinic dynasty. Soloveitch is the Anglicization of the name Soloveitchik. Okay, so the president of Yale is a cousin of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So thinking back to that occasion, I wondered whether there was a more than merely family connection between the university president and his great distant relative, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, the man known to generations of his students as the Rav. Was there an intellectual and spiritual link also? And here's what he came away with. So who's Peter Soloveitch? So Peter Soloveitch is the psychologist who created the concept of emotional intelligence. Right, so there is, and it is significant. Peter Soloveitch's great contribution to the thought of our time is the concept he formulated together with John Mayer in a landmark 1989 article named Emotional Intelligence, popularized in 1995 by Daniel Goleman's best-selling book and the same title, Emotional Intelligence. So he now gives a background to psychology. I'll say it outside, but for decades, and the truth is it's still true to some extent now, it's been a long time fighting this, but people use IQ, your intelligence quotient, how quote-unquote smart you are, your reasoning skills, your cognitive skills, as a measure of how good you're going to be in school, how good you're going to be at work. It's all intellectual. What emotional intelligence says is that not only is that not showing the full picture, you're missing what's probably even more important, which is that our ability to understand and respond to not only our own emotions, but to those of others is an essential element of success in many fields, indeed of human interaction in general. We need to be able to understand our own emotions, and we need to be able to understand other people's emotions. We need to be able to manage our own emotions, and we need to be able to manage other people's emotions, or at least manage around other people's emotions. And if we don't have those skills, you can be high IQ, but not very successful in your job. So emotional intelligence is essential for success in life, success in career. And now, what does this have to do with Rabbi Soloveitchik? So he quotes a famous idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik said in a tribute to the Rebbetzin of Tolna. He was giving a eulogy. And he distinguishes between what he learned from his own father and what he learned from his mother. From his father, he said, we learn how to read a text, comprehend, analyze, conceptualize, classify, infer, and apply. Basically, cognitive, thinking skills is what he got from his father. It's an intellectual endeavor. But teaching of your mother, what did he learn from his mother? I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and warmth to mitzvos. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teaching, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. So his father gave him the cognitive, his mother gave him the emotional. And Rabbi Sachs, sort of concludes or summarizes the idea. To put it in other words, Torah Imecha, what we gain from our mothers, is about emotional intelligence. He's long felt that alongside Rabbi Soloveitchik's great essay, Halachic Man, which is one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous books, there would be another one he might have written called Agadic Woman. Halacha is an intellectual moral enterprise, but Agada is the non-halachic dimension of rabbinic Judaism. It's the broader aspects, what it means to be a Jew. It's written in narrative rather than law. It invites our enter the minds and hearts of our spiritual forebearers. Basically, there's two paradigms here of the intellect and the emotion. The intellect is paradigmatic of the halachic man, the father, and the Torah Imecha is the agada, the narrative, the emotional aspects of Judaism. Where Soloveitchik's not going to be so happy with a male-female dichotomy, because that seems to be saying, you know, one's for a man and one's for a woman, and that the never two shall meet. But remember, especially if you go with Damasio, the two are intertwined. You can't separate your intellect from your emotion. So he says, speaking personally, I'm disinclined to think of it in terms of a male-female dichotomy. We are called on to develop both sensibilities. Right? We need to be both intellectual, whether you're a man or woman, and you have to be emotional, whether you're a man or a woman. And he says, for those who are familiar with, is a famous motif throughout his writings, is that there's a priestly voice, which is more cognitive, lahavdil, to distinguish, analyze, categorize, and to guide, instruct. And then there's the prophetic voice, which is the righteousness, the justice, the kindness, the compassion. So the priestly voice is more of the cognitive. The prophetic voice is more of the emotional. And we need to have both in our personalities, and we need to have both in our Judaism. And then he concludes. Why? Because at the very end of his... what does that have to do with the Parsha? So Hazinu, again, the song. Why does Moshe end with song? Why does the Torah end with a song? Why? Because at the very end of his life, the greatest of all prophets turned to emotional intelligence, knowing that unless he did so, his teachings might enter the midst of the Israelites, but not their hearts, their passions, their emotive DNA. It is feelings that move us to act, give us the energy to aspire, and fuel our ability to hand on our commitments to those who come after us. This is a life-changing idea. If you want to change lives, speak to people's feelings, not just to their minds. And that's what Moshe does at the end of his life. He speaks in song. He speaks in emotion, because that's the only way you can give it over to the next generation. And I told you I would reference Rabbi Sachs. Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg from Boca Raton Synagogue just released a interview that he had with Rabbi Sachs that he didn't publish, and just published it after he passed away. There's a link to it. I highly recommend you listen to it. It's 20, 25 minutes long, and bullet points, awesome sound bites, and off-the-cuff remarks. It wasn't planned in advance. And one of the things that Rabbi Goldberg asked Rabbi Sachs is, what are the things that we need to improve on in the modern Orthodox world, or I guess the Orthodox world in general? And I would assume that the same would be applied to the broader context of humanity as well. And he said, we have to work on the emotions. We have to work on the affect. We have to work, and he quoted specifically, on singing. And he said that he made it his job when he was the chief rabbi to make sure that there were, he would work with chazanim. He would make sure the right chazan was there, singing songs that got the congregation involved, that there'd be a harmony, that people can experience the emotional aspect of davening and the emotional experience of Judaism. And as I get the feeling, maybe I'm out of place here, but this is almost parallel, what he's writing is almost parallel to what he's experiencing, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of his life, realizes we need to focus on the affective more. We need to focus on song. Now, Rabbi Sachs didn't just wake up at the end of his life and figure this out, and perhaps no more did Moshe Rabbeinu as well. But you see an added emphasis on the Descartes, on the emotion, on how we have to develop the affective. It's not just about philosophy. It's not just about intellect. There is a morality here. There's justice. There's compassion. These are all things that we should be talking about and we should be working on. And that's the legacy, one of the many legacies that Rabbi Sachs leaves for us, is that the importance, yes, of Torah and Chachma, the importance of what Torah can say for the outside world and what the outside world can say and help us understand Torah, but that there's an added emphasis on understanding how the psychology of emotions work so that we can better work on the affective component of our religion. Without that, that's a life-changing idea. If you want to change lives, speak to people's feelings, not just to their minds. And I close with the following quote. So I wrote this for this week. Every week this is a personal element, right? So I write every week a Psych for Torah. I take an element of psychology and tie it to the Parsha. And there's no question that Rabbi Sachs's writings are, besides the fact that I read them every week, besides for that, the whole approach is very influential on how I look at the Parsha. And I take what I know about psychology and I take what I know about Torah and I see how they can fit together to gain a message that's impactful, meaningful, relevant, both to us as Jews, and perhaps maybe if I learn from Rabbi Sachs even more, be able to frame that in a way that can impact the broader world as well. So in this week's Psych for Torah, I wrote up, and I'll, for those who subscribe, you'll get this tomorrow. I wrote up a summary of some of these ideas, as well as an application to the Parsha, which I did not discuss, my own application of a fourth time. Rabbi Sachs quotes Damasio three times for the Parsha, so I quote him a fourth time to understand perhaps a different insight into Parshas Chayesara. But I conclude, which what I think is a good way of concluding this presentation as well, is Rabbi Sachs himself epitomized this integration between intellect and emotions. Not one, it's not the other, right? Damasio, the whole point is that you can't separate them completely. His towering intellect was infused with input from his moral emotions. His religious and philosophic rationality was suffused with spiritual sentiments. Using his own terminology, we can say about him that he was both halachic man and agadic woman. He was both the priestly voice of analyzing and the prophetic voice of justice and compassion. He was someone who preached so eloquently, but more importantly, demonstrated what he preached through his personality. To continue this aspect of his multifaceted legacy, we are charged to develop both our intellect and our emotions and integrate them in the service of God and humanity. We are all mourning his loss. We have a lot to learn, and there's a lot to gain. And I hope this was one aspect that gave you a perspective on who he was, what his writing was about, what he believed in, what his goals were. And it's really up to us to pick that up and to move with it. So if there's any questions, feel free to ask them.